holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a morning news and public affairs director, as well as an evening news and public affairs director to manage the news and public affairs programming. For these two full-time positions, we're looking for people with proven experience in audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply for both of these positions is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Country Fair, July 12th through 14th in Vineta, Oregon, celebrating 50 years featuring music, food, vaudeville, and more. Tickets and parking passes available through Tickets West, online at ticketswest.com. Shuttle service available at the Valley River Center. More information for this family-friendly event at OregonCountryFair.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Frank Gable has been released from the Oregon State Penitentiary.
The Proud Boys are marching in downtown Portland on Saturday.
And Amazon warehouse workers nationwide are coming together to fight for better working conditions from the corporate giant.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 28th, 2019. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Patriot Prayer is marching in downtown Portland on Saturday, and Rose City Antifa is encouraging counter-protesters to come out as well. The two demonstrations start at noon. Rose City Antifa is gathering in Chapman Square, but it's not clear where the Proud Boys are gathering. Portland police in a statement today said protests are expected in Pioneer Square, Chapman Square, and Waterfront Park, and that police will be stationed at all three locations. The police said there were no known permits or plans for any street marches. In a statement this week, Antifa said, quote, "The Proud Boys hate group is planning to invade downtown Portland looking for targets for violent attacks," end quote.
Frank Gable has been released from the Oregon State Penitentiary. Gable has been incarcerated for nearly 30 years for the 1989 killing of Oregon prison director Michael Franke and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. A U.S. magistrate found in April that the trial court made an error in excluding evidence of third-party guilt. U.S. Magistrate Judge John Villacosta also found that Gable's attorneys provided him with, quote, ineffective assistance in failing to assert Gable's federal due process rights in the face of a trial court's error. Gable, now 59 years old, left prison in Lansing, Kansas, and had to report directly to a federal probation officer in Kansas City. He'll be allowed to live with his wife in Kansas. Frankie's brothers, Pat and Kevin Franke, have been staunch defenders of Gable and believe he was wrongfully convicted. The April ruling came after multiple witnesses recanted their testimony, and defense lawyers cited a record of improper interrogation and flawed polygraphs used to question witnesses and shape their statements to police.
Amazon warehouse workers nationwide are coming together to fight for better working conditions from the corporate giant. On Tuesday, July 16th, workers will be rallying at the Hillsboro warehouse, and on Wednesday, July 17th, the rally will be held in Portland. KBOO's Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio this week aired interviews with two Amazon whistleblowers about the issues they face. The workers' voices have been disguised to protect their identities.
We have absolutely no control over the amount of work we're expected to do on any given day. We are constantly told this is the amount of volume that we have to push through. And that number could be extremely high one day compared to the other days where it might have been in an average of something. But that extremely high volume is then just that's the workload and you've got to do it. So that means very often that we'll be worked extra hard just because, and we can't, what do we say about it? What do we do about it? Thankfully, there is a little bit of pushback from some of the workers as far as like how long we will work. But if we weren't pushing back, they would just keep working us. But we've actually had to say we're not going to work past certain times, and we're not going to take this kind of treatment. So I would also say that just the facilities are really run down. You would go into this warehouse and see the way that the bathrooms look, see the way that the break rooms are, try using the microwaves, and you would have the impression that this was a company that was going under, that was running on an incredibly low budget. And it is, because they are constantly trying to push costs down and efficiency up. So what we end up with is an environment where if we stand still at certain times, depends on the manager. If we stand still, a manager will come up to us and say, "What are you doing? Are you getting any work done?" They've started to try to track whether we're actually doing anything at all by saying if they assign us to a job in the warehouse that isn't normally monitored by our devices, because we have devices that monitor us most of the time. But if they assign us to something else, then they start scanning our badges and say that they're doing some tracking of labor to make sure that they can show why people weren't for 15 or 20 minutes doing the roles that they were expected to. Also, we get the minimum mandated break time, which is 10 minutes, but we are doing incredibly physical work, and that 10 minutes is the shortest period of time that we could possibly have, especially when you are, if you're starting very early or if you're starting very late, which is common to be doing odd hours. The first break that you get is going to be, you've got 10 minutes with a little bit of commute time on either side, and if you're a minute late, you're going to get written up, you're going to have someone standing there shaming you, and you will get yelled at about it in the morning. It's at times a militaristic environment, but that varies based on managers. Some try to be nice about it, but they're all given a script that says, that essentially shames us for wanting to take rest, and shames us for wanting to not have to work twice as hard one day and make the exact same amount of money. So at times it feels like the warehouse is run more by an algorithm than it is by human beings, and that when the manager says someone higher up, sometimes it's unclear if that was a machine that told them what to do, and that they're just trying to follow orders from literally a machine that has said how much we should be expected to do. And then when the human reality comes in and butts up against that, then suddenly everyone in management is depressed because they're not meeting their quota. And we're like, well, we're just relieved that we got to stop working on time and go to lunch on time. Like, that's a nice little bonus for the day. So
what would you say are some of the main problems besides these that your comrade has mentioned that you're dealing with?
I just have big issues of lack of safety, of there are people with special needs and or deaf, and there is often not the appropriate things that they need to either be able to safely see that, you know, a drive lane is safe to walk across if there's a sound that they cannot hear because they are deaf. Proper first aid. Like, just having the right size Band-Aid can make a world of difference. After complaining about or just letting management know that you're injured or that there is something hurting, just go a little longer and see how it feels then.
That was KBOO's Jamie Partridge speaking with Amazon Warehouse whistleblowers about their working conditions. The Supreme Court yesterday ruled against the inclusion of a question of U.S. citizenship in the 2020 census. Chief Justice Roberts, the sole swing vote in the 5-4 ruling, stated in his decision that the Trump administration's request for the question's inclusion, quote, seems to have been contrived. Court records show that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had aggressively solicited the Department of Homeland Security and then the Department of Justice to gain rationale for the request. The court's decision does not rule out future requests for citizenship data to be added to the census, but with forms scheduled to hit the presses in 2 days, inclusion on 2020 forms would seem unlikely. President Trump has stated he may move to delay the census by executive order until the question can be included. However, to legally delay the census would require legislators to amend the Census Act.
Yesterday, Multnomah County elected officials and community organizers held a press conference on the U.S. Supreme Court's refusal to take up the addition of a citizenship question on the U.S. Census. Latino Network Director Carmen Rubio outlined exactly how the issue could impact local communities.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Carmen Rubio, and I'm the Executive Director of Latino Network. The Supreme Court's decision to not allow the citizenship question will lead to a more equitable and complete count of our communities, which have been historically undercounted and underrepresented. Latino Network is a Latino-led, Latino-serving, social service provider here in the metro region. Each year, we serve over 7,200 families in Multnomah County and Washington County and provide the Latinx community with access to culturally specific education, early childhood services, family stability services, and provide critical wraparound supports to at-risk youth and their families. These programs would not be possible without state and local investments that are allocated every year using valuable census information. That means that our Latinx and immigrant community participation in the 2020 census is crucial. The census is used to ensure that all our communities receive their fair share of federal and state funding for critical services like schools, clinics, hospitals, transportation options, parks, and housing programs. The new population count from this census will also determine our political representation in Congress and at the state level, which is very much needed. Since the 2016 election, the Trump administration has engaged in harmful, mean-spirited, anti-immigrant rhetoric and has initiated multiple attacks against our communities. The culture of fear and anxiety is pervasive. These words have real impacts on real lives. As a culturally specific organization, we have had to step up our efforts to address the safety and crisis preparedness and trauma of our staff, our participants, partners, and community residents at large. If a citizenship question were added, we know that many people in households with immigrants, including those who are U.S. citizens, would simply choose not to fill out the census form, and that has disastrous effects for our local community. And this would continue their recession in more deeply into fear. That means our communities would continue to be underserved, underrepresented, and left without a real political voice. We reject this. We cannot let this continue. And we applaud the Supreme Court's decision to hold this administration accountable for their unlawful efforts to discourage our communities from participating in the census. But like others have said, we know our work is far from over. Whether it's decided that a citizenship question will be included or not, we must continue to work to ensure that all communities are counted in 2020. We urge all of us to hold our government accountable and demand fair and equal representation of all of those who reside and contribute to our communities. Thank you.
That was Latino Network Director Carmen Rubio yesterday speaking on the Supreme Court's ruling on the U.S. Census.
Oregon Senate Republicans announced today they will come back to work by 9 a.m. on Saturday morning. The conservative lawmakers have spent more than a week hiding outside the state to block proposed cap-and-trade legislation against climate change. The Republican walkout ground the legislature to a halt and prompted them to declare victory in the political crisis that pitted 11 GOP lawmakers against a Democratic supermajority. The Associated Press reported today Senate Minority Leader Herman Bartschiger says he's confident the Senate can work through the stalled docket of more than 100 unfinished measures before the legislative session ends at midnight Sunday. As the political crisis dragged on, Democrats said they didn't have enough votes, even within their own caucus, to pass the proposal targeting climate-changing emissions. Bartschiger said, quote, "Our mission was to kill cap and trade, and that's what we did."
listening to the KBOO Evening News. At 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. And then at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with lows around 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, partly sunny with highs close to 80 degrees. Today in history, 1 year ago, a gunman opened fire in the offices of the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland, killing 5 journalists, editorial writer Gerald Fishman, associate editor Rob Heisen, news reporter John McNamara, advertising assistant Rebecca Smith, and features columnist Wendy Winters. Today's survivors dedicated a garden to their memory. It was the deadliest attack on a media outlet in U.S. history. The quote of the day is from Salman Rushdie, who said, quote, "The great concern is that year after year, rising numbers of journalists are being killed in pursuit of their work. They're increasingly seen as not being neutral, but rather as a combatants by one side or another," end quote.
An air passenger sued the FBI for confiscating $121,000 in cash at the Portland airport and refusing to return it, even though the man was never charged with a crime. Now the FBI wants Stephen Williams' lawsuit thrown out because they say he waited too long to ask for the money back. In April of last year, FBI agents boarded the jet where Williams was a passenger waiting to depart on a flight to Phoenix. Williams had a duffel bag packed with the cash, which was noted by TSA screeners as he passed through security, and the screeners called the FBI even though he was not breaking any law. A federal lawsuit filed by Williams against the FBI says 3 agents asked him to explain why he was carrying the cash. Williams' lawyer says his client is in the car business and was taking the money to Arizona to purchase a vehicle. In a response to Williams' lawsuit Monday, Assistant United States Attorney Kevin Danielson wrote that the FBI notified Williams in June of last year that he had 35 days to contest the seizure or the money would be forfeited. Danielson wrote that Williams signed for the certified letter on June 25th, but Williams and his lawyer did not file a claim for the cash until November. Williams and his lawyer asked the FBI for an additional $50,000 for substantial emotional distress plus interest.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. A Utah high school prohibited a Navajo student from wearing eagle feathers on her graduation cap during the school's commencement ceremony. The Salt Lake Tribune reports Tashina Savala was waiting to walk up to receive her diploma when a teacher noticed the 3 feathers and demanded she remove them. The Lehigh High School principal told the paper the teacher was enforcing a policy against decorating graduation caps, and he said the removal of the feathers was a misunderstanding. He implies Savala could have worn the regalia had she arranged it with school administrators beforehand. The Tribune reports Savala is one of 7 Native students of the more than 1,500 students at the school. Tribal leaders in Southeast Alaska are pushing for a change in mining law. The Klukwan tribal government is hoping to stop a proposed copper mine at the headwaters of the Chilkat River they say threatens their existence. KHNS's Claire Strempel reports.
Tribal President Kimberly Strong says that an international mining interest upstream poses an existential threat to thousands of years of Tlingit history.
I don't want to go down in history as the last tribal leader of the Chilkat Indian village of Klukwan.
She fears tailings from Constantine Metal Resources' proposed copper-zinc mine could pollute the river that sustains tribal citizens.
The Chilkat River feeds us financially, culturally, spiritually, and literally. And the toxic discharge of a mine directly upstream will wipe us off the map.
She met with lawmakers in Washington, D.C. that want to change a century-old law and reform the mining industry. Her message was well-received by Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva. In his view, the mining law of 1872 is outdated.
The fundamental reform of an industry. It's just not the old West, it's the new West, with different demands for the use of our natural resources and an increased ethic of conservation and protection.
Grijalva sponsored a new bill. It would allow federal agencies to deny mining claims on public land. A representative from the National Mining Association said the legislation jeopardizes the mining industry in Alaska and across the country. Representative Grijalva says existing law makes permitting a closed process, but the reform would require meaningful consultation with tribes. That's something the Klukwan Tlingit say they were denied by Alaska's Dunleavy administration in regards to the Constantine claim. For National Native News, I'm Claire Strempel.
The man who pleaded guilty to kidnapping, raping, and murdering a young Navajo girl in 2016 is seeking to reverse his life sentence. The Farmington Daily Times reports Tom Begay Jr. has filed a motion in federal court stating he didn't have a competent attorney and he was not aware of his rights. Begay said he has a low IQ and didn't understand the charges against him. Begay also argued he was drunk on the day he kidnapped Ashlyn Mike, and therefore the crime could not be a premeditated act of first-degree murder. He's seeking an evidentiary hearing and a lesser charge. The Tribal Council for the Picayune Rancheria of Chukchansi Indians voted this week to suspend memberships of 60 people. The suspensions are pending formal disenrollment hearings. The vote reverses an action 2 years ago to grant tribal status to the same 60 people. In a written statement to the Fresno Bee, Tribal Council Chairwoman Jennifer Ruiz said those subject to the suspension do not meet the requirements for tribal enrollment. It's the latest in a series of tumultuous enrollment decisions by the tribe, which operates the Chukchansi Gold Resort and Casino. Over the last decade, the tribe has disenrolled hundreds of one-time members. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
U.S. senators today failed to pass an amendment which would require Donald Trump to get congressional approval before launching military strikes against Iran. Unlike GOP state senators in Oregon who bent the rules over the past week to avoid a vote on cap-and-trade legislation, Republican U.S. senators showed historic flexibility in allowing Democrats to participate. CNN reported this afternoon that meant gaveling open the session before sunrise on a day they were supposed to be gone for the Independence Day holiday. Republicans also allowed Democrats to preside over the chamber, keeping the vote open for a record-breaking length of time rather than the usual half hour. They also agreed that if the amendment were to pass, it would retroactively be added to a defense authorization bill that had passed the Senate the day before, which is practically unheard of. It still failed. Jack Reed, a Democrat who is the ranking member on the Senate Armed Services Committee, had this to say about the current Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action yesterday, before the vote was held.
Mr. President, I rise today to discuss the escalating tensions between the United States and Iran, and my concern about the administration's current approach, a path that I am worried will lead us to war, and my support for the Udall Amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, which will be voted on tomorrow. I believe that diplomatic efforts, in concert with our international partners, should be pursued immediately to avoid another unnecessary armed conflict in the Middle East. Let me be clear. Iran is a dangerous and destabilizing force in the region. It supports terrorist proxies and meddles in the internal affairs of other states. Iran continues to pursue ballistic missile capabilities in violation of international norms and abuses the rights of its own people. Unfortunately, the administration's chosen course of action with respect to Iran has isolated the United States from the international community and made it more difficult to collectively address these issues. The administration's actions and rhetoric related to Iran have created a credibility deficit. This is a fast-changing and dangerous situation, and it is clear that there is not a consensus within the international community with respect to Iran's plans and intentions. Given these disconnects, it is imperative for the administration to provide Congress with current, unvarnished intelligence so that we may reach substantiated conclusions. Taking a step back, it is important to recount the actions that have precipitated the current state of affairs. Current tensions are an entirely predictable outcome of the administration's ill-conceived approach to Iran. Despite then-candidate Trump's campaign rhetoric, I and others hope that he would heed the advice of his advisors with respect to the Iran nuclear agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. For example, despite personal concerns about the JCPOA before it was signed, former Secretary of Defense Mattis told the Armed Services Committee at his confirmation hearing that, quote, when America gives her word, we have to live up to it and work with our allies. In October 2017, Secretary Mattis told the Armed Services Committee that he believed it was in our national interest to remain in the JCPOA. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, echoed these sentiments at the time and cautioned that, in his words, the United States would incur damage vis-a-vis our allies if we unilaterally withdraw from the JCPOA. Our allies would be less likely to cooperate with us on future military action to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, and less likely to cooperate with us on countering other destabilizing aspects of Iranian behavior that threaten our collective interests. The administration should have sought to work with the international community to address the challenges posed by Iran by building upon the foundation of the JCPOA rather than squandering that opportunity in favor of putting Iran on notice and other inflammatory rhetoric. Just over a year ago, President Trump made the disastrous decision to unilaterally withdraw the United States from the JCPOA and reimpose nuclear-rated sanctions in violation of previous U.S. commitments under the deal. Since withdrawing from the deal, the Trump administration has taken a series of additional escalatory actions, including the imposition of new sanctions on various aspects of the Iranian economy, cancellation of waivers that previously allowed importation of Iranian oil by China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey, and the designation of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, often referred to as the IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. The designation of a foreign government entity as a foreign terrorist organization was unprecedented, and it is not clear what purpose it served, other than to unnecessarily raise tensions with Iran. As I learned during a recent visit to Iraq and Afghanistan, the IRGC designation has significantly complicated our relationships with foreign partners who describe the action as provocative and destabilizing. While the JCPOA was not a perfect deal, it was a necessary deal. It is important to remember that when the JCPOA was signed, Iran's breakout timeline, or the amount of time Iran would need to produce enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon, was only 2 to 3 months. The JCPOA, even by the most conservative estimates, stretched that timeline to more than a year. By all accounts, the JCPOA has worked as intended. The JCPOA commits Iran to never seeking to develop or acquire a nuclear weapon and effectively cuts off all pathways for Iran to achieve a nuclear weapon until at least 2030. The agreement dramatically reduced Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium and the number of installed centrifuges. It also prevented Iran from producing weapons-grade plutonium and has subjected Iran to the most intrusive monitoring regime in the world to ensure it is living up to its commitments. The JCPOA was appropriately built upon the concept of distrust and verify.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 28th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Leslie McClam, Alex Connor, and Ron Bead, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein looks at why the Kalama Methanol Refinery has now become the focus of a regional climate campaign with two activists from the Puget Sound region who have been involved in the methanol struggle. At 11, First Voices Radio guests include author Ross Hamilton and Indigenous archaeologist Dr. Paulette Steves. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.FM or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for a live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use.